Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. Today I'm here with Fiona and we are interviewing my parents. So welcome to the podcast, Mum and Dad, also known as Sam and Priya, for those of you who are not children of my parents. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are going to chat to Sam and Priya about migrating to Australia and a bit of the story that they had growing up in Sri Lanka and how they came to here and the journey that that was. But to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Okay, so my name is Priya and I grew up in Sri Lanka in a place called Kandy up in the hills. And I reckon I had an idyllic childhood. I had one brother of my own and I had three stepsisters, but sadly two of them have passed away now. But my brother and I were very close. We grew up in a loving family and it was a wonderful time.
Dad?
I grew up in a town called Mount Lavinia, which is very close to Colombo, our capital city. We were a household of my parents and then there were four siblings, three brothers and one sister. And I'm the eldest, so we started life in Sri Lanka and went to a school close by, which was actually a public school modeled on the schools in UK. So we had a very good education, especially English and everything. So I was lucky that way. And it was during, of course, by the time we had just got our own independence. We were a colony of the British. And so that's a little bit of a sketch of, you know, how I began life in Sri Lanka.
And so now you both live in Melbourne, but we'll come to how you got here in a moment. You have three girls, of which I'm the oldest.
Yes, I do.
Have been in Melbourne now for how many years?
38 years.
So both of you are baby boomers. Maybe just keeping that in mind for our listeners that both of you are baby boomers, maybe start telling us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Sri Lanka.
For one thing is we didn't have labels in Sri Lanka. I never knew I was a baby boomer till I came to Australia and I got that label. But growing up in Sri Lanka, it was very traditional. My father went to work. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, but we had a lot of domestic help, so I did not have to do any work myself. Mm. So after, when I got married, it was a rude shock for me that I had to learn how to cook and do things.
How much domestic help did you have? Like, when you say domestic help for our listeners, that wouldn't necessarily...
Well, cooking and cleaning and gardening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a few different people.
Yeah.
More than one.
Person. But now people come during the day, a helper would come during the day, do the work and go. Whereas we had residents, they stayed with us. That was the biggest difference at the time when I was growing up. And in fact, two of the boys who came to us when they were very young as domestic helpers, and they came mostly because their parents were so poor they couldn't afford to keep them. But those two boys, my mother educated them, in a sense that she tutored them, taught them English, and sent them to night school when they finished their, you know, domestic chores. And they're both now doing extremely well in the US.
Wow. Yeah.
They still keep in contact with me.
So your family had a different type of relationship, really, to the help.
Yeah.
It wasn't what typical families in Sri Lanka might
have done. My mother always treated our domestic help extremely well.
Yeah,
and my elder sister's husband was in the working for the United Nations, so they were allowed to take helpers out with them as part of their work contract. So they were living in the U.S., and so these two boys, my mother realized that they had no future in Sri Lanka, so she sent them through my sister. So they stayed with my sister under contract for 2 years, and then they branched out on their own.
And then you went to school and high school in Kandy?
Yeah, I went to girls' high school in Kandy. I used to walk to school sometimes. Sometimes my dad would drop me, and there was this long tunnel I had to walk through. It's funny now, you know, I never felt any fear. Now I would, if you told me I'm walking through this tunnel to go to school, I would be petrified. thinking something would happen to you, but, you know, I had no fear walking through that tunnel. I mean, there were all people walking through, but it had the potential for predators to lurk there.
Wow. And one thing for our listeners, the school uniform for both girls and boys is white.
All girls' uniforms were white. All girls.
Were boys white as well?
They wore white shirts.
White shirts and, coloured pants, probably blue or something.
The only thing that identified different schools was the ties that we wore, school ties, or the necklines of the uniform would be a different colour. But all school uniforms were, at that time, white.
And generally, school would start quite early, wouldn't it?
I think it started at 7:30.
And finished at 1:30. Avoid the heat of the day.
Oh.
Dad, for you, you also did primary school and high school in...
Yes, lucky to go to this public school, which was very good, very famous for sports and education as well. And so that continued till I finished my university entrance exam and then to take it further. Fortunately, we had very few universities at that time. There was only one big university, which close to Kandy, where Priya used to live. Then later on, there were other universities also that came up in Colombo and everything. But this one university was quite good in the sense that the courses they ran and did was all recognized by the UK. And so we had that sort of added benefit of, our education being recognized, And so that helped me in a big way because once I did work for about 13 years in Sri Lanka. By the way, I qualified as an engineer and then worked for a telecommunication company and for 13 years. And so all the education and everything helped in a big way. So we were sort of instrumental in, developing the country in its own telecommunication journey. So it was a very interesting time. And being an engineer, I was very interested in technology and things like that.
So you went to the main university.
Correct.
And you always knew you wanted to do engineering.
Yes, I always had that engineering bent, and even in school, like maths and physics and those sort of subjects were more appealing to me. I had some good friends as well in school, and two of us got through to do engineering at the university, which was great, and because I had a big competition to get into courses, being the one university, it was not enough.
Not enough places.
To, offer places for everybody. And so it was quite competitive, yeah.
And Mum, where did you go to university and what did you study?
Well, my mother was the same university that Daddy is talking about. Was very close to my house. When I say very close, like a bus ride away. But my mother was petrified of sending me there because there was what... In Sri Lanka, the university students have this initiation. They call it ragging, and it could be quite severe. I was not a very science-oriented student anyway at the best of times. So, I was, it's not as though I was going to end up doing medicine or engineering or anything like that. So she decided to, because some of my cousins were studying in India, and my mother, and they were raving about how good it was in India. And so my mother just got that into her head that she should send me to India to study. So I went there when I was 17, I remember. That was the first time I had left home, first time I had left the country. I remember flying from Colombo to, and my mother cried at the airport, which made me feel horrible.
Goodness.
My aunt was with me, that she came with me up to Madras, and then I had to take a train from Madras up to this place, up in the hills again, in a place called Ooty, where I did, it was like a university entrance, they called it pre-university. And it was a wonderful time. I felt the education, I just enjoyed it. I just had a great time because I learned French, which we never did in Sri Lanka. And English, and then I made lots of friends there. And it was like a resort, actually. Ooty was considered a resort town. So I just had a ball. I don't know how well I did in my studies, but I just had a ball. And then I came, after my first year, I came back to I mean, I came home, obviously. But the thing is, because those days there was the letter, postal system was such that by the time my results came and was posted to Sri Lanka and I got it and reapplied to do an undergraduate degree, it was all the courses that I wanted to do had been filled.
Oh.
So I had to end up doing whatever was available, which was English literature, which I didn't mind, but it wasn't a degree that was going to take me anywhere because I was really not interested in teaching. And
okay.
I felt that that was the only thing. The only thing I was vaguely interested at that time was in doing linguistics. But when I came back, I knew my parents couldn't support me in India longer than the 4 years I spent. So when I came back to Colombo, Sri Lanka, I tried to pursue that, but none of the universities were offering it. So okay. I had to drop that.
And I guess for context, back when you both were kind of going through university, Sri Lanka had a population of...
About 9.5 to 10 million.
Yeah, and like only really one or two big-ish universities, but they didn't all offer all these courses.
No.
So I guess it's just to put it in context in terms of... In today, in Melbourne, we do have a lot of universities
yeah.
that offer a lot of diversity. So, you know, I think it's a very different time of growing up and kind of what you can study and what you can learn as
but
well.
But don't forget, Darshini, we were a third world country.
Yes.
We were considered a third world country. And previously we had had the Dutch and the Portuguese and finally the British. The British were the ones who were, I think, really... helped us. I mean, there are varying views. Some would not quite agree with what I'm saying, but I felt the British were the ones who really brought our standard up in Sri Lanka.
Yeah. Okay.
Everyone would not agree with
yeah.
me, but this is most people would.
And also the thinking at that time was most parents would like their children either to be a doctor, engineer, or maybe accountant or something.
Yeah.
So they were the three main professions that they would like to see their children excel in. You know, there wasn't the, you know, variety of courses that, you know, one could do today and pursue one's own, you know, what you're good at or whatever the case may be. So because it was all very limited, you know, the university placements were, you know, you had to be really good to be selected for university, because even my engineering course, they used to have only about 110 or something like that
wow.
as an intake. So you can just imagine in a country so big, that's all they could do at the time.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I was always interested in design.
Yeah.
And now when I think about, you know, how I always doing patchwork quilts and the design that I put into that, that was my gifting. So I remember talking to my parents about doing fabric design, and there was a university in India, in the northern part of India, that I could have gone to. But then again, my mother said, no, you get your basic degree first, and then you can do anything else. But then my parents were old also by the time we were born. It was my father's second marriage, so, you know, he wasn't young. And I knew they wouldn't be able to afford to send me there, because my brother was, at that time, had come to India to do engineering at one of the IITs, which is, they are very prestigious universities. And so his education was more important. So I dropped that.
Okay.
So what I'm really interested in is, how did you two actually meet?
When I came back to Sri Lanka, I couldn't get a job in Kandy. Kandy is a very small town. So I started doing a secretarial course, shorthand typing, that kind of thing. And then I got a job in Colombo. And when I was in Colombo, I joined a youth organization called Campus Crusade for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And Daddy used to come occasionally there. And actually, Daddy's younger brother, Mike, used to help me. Because like I have no head for figures, I am the first to admit it. Mike used to come and help me. With the books and things.
My uncle Mike is an accountant.
Oh, okay. He's a CFO.
And so he'd help you do the books.
Yeah, so that's how we sort of met. Then I invited you to that concert, because you liked music, and I invited you to that organ recital by then. I paid for the tickets, you didn't pay me back.
All these years later.
I thought I was getting an invite.
So you asked him out.
Because he kept saying, parroting about, I was working in an advertising agency at that time. And so I knew about this concert that was coming up, and I could get the tickets for it. So I asked him, oh, do you want to come? And my brother came too. So it
It
wasn't a date.
I don't think I would have been allowed to do that growing up. So you guys dated for how long before you got married?
Not very long.
Very short, maybe under a year, I think.
6 months or something. Mm.
Was that normal at the time?
No, but Daddy was not young and neither was I. We were both, you were 35 or something, and I was 26. Well, so that was considered really old in Sri Lanka, not to be married at that time.
What I find fascinating about that is that's probably quite average ages nowadays for young people getting married. Yeah.
The most frustrating thing, Fiona, was that constantly people would ask my mother, why isn't your daughter married?
Yeah.
Why isn't your daughter married?
I think about my own parents, 21 when they got married. You know, my dad was a little bit older. I think he was 25, but 21, wow.
But when they're asking that question, they'd ask that more for the female, right? Yeah. Like, why are you not married? Yeah. Like, it was okay to be a single male?
Yeah. I think there was not the same level of, pressure, in the sense that if you're a girl, then they expect you to get married young.
Yeah. So 26 was considered
old.
Old. Goodness.
On the shelf.
Then you get married, and then what happens?
Okay, so there were quite a lot of changes at the time we got married. So what happened was, I was working in this garment department and as an engineer, and a lot of exciting work was happening because we were doing a lot of major projects and things like that. Heavily involved in very interesting work, and we had a lot of foreign engineers also who used to help us, and so we worked alongside, and there were a lot of knowledge transfer and all that kind of thing happening. So I was quite wrapped doing this, and so I was just thinking of just carrying on in Sri Lanka, and working. But
Can I continue? So we were living with Daddy's father and Uncle Mike as well. So in his parental home is where we were living, which was not ideal for a first year of marriage. But anyway, there was no hope for us to buy a house of our own, because the government pays were very little, and even with my pay at the advertising agency, it wasn't all that crash, it wasn't a big amount. So at that time, my aunt, who was working as a principal of a school in Nigeria, had a friend who was coming to Colombo to recruit teachers, because Nigeria was just booming because of their oil boom. And so they were recruiting teachers and engineers and all sorts of things. But this man was coming particularly to recruit teachers. So my aunt said, oh, would you take him out? And we did that. We took him around Colombo for a week or so. And then he kept telling Daddy, why don't you apply to come to Nigeria? And Daddy was saying, no, I'm very happy here. I've got a lot of things. But that guy kept pestering Daddy. And in fact, I think on the day he was leaving Colombo, Daddy handed him a resume, because he kept asking for it all the time. And then 6 months later, we didn't hear anything. 6 months later, Daddy got an offer of a job, no interview, nothing, saying, come to Nigeria, to come to Lagos.
So how did you feel, Dad, when you got this job offer, considering you weren't thinking of leaving?
Like Priya said, it's very difficult to start life in Sri Lanka on your own. And even for everyday living, what you get as a pay would be just enough for you to maybe just for the food only. You can't do any big rental payments or anything like that.
Can't save much money.
So invariably you're stuck, and you may have to work a long time before you can really be on your own, sort of thing. Unfortunately, you get caught up in this lifestyle, where you're enjoying your work and you keep going. And of course, after you got married, then you have to start thinking of, your future and what are you going to do about this. And actually, Priya's aunt just said, even for a few years, if you go out and work, then it'll give you some kind of, income, which you can then maybe come back to Sri Lanka, and then it'll help you to set up,
Yeah.
So which made a lot of sense. And So, of course, this thing happened, and then to cut a long story short, the this job offer came, and then I had to decide. Now, I had a big problem because I'm not thinking of leaving everything in Sri Lanka, you know, quitting my job and then taking up this appointment. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe I'll go for 3 years. 3 years was the contract. And then come back. But then the problem is, who is going to hold the job for you, you know? Mm. So I had to go to my boss and ask him, look, I would like to have 3 years leave. And then I'm thinking of coming back. And then he said, so in those days, things are so difficult in Sri Lanka to get that approval. Your application has to go through your permanent secretary of your particular telecommunication ministry or whatever, right up to the prime minister for
approval. Stop it.
Yeah.
You had to get approval from the prime minister.
You won't believe this because, look, we are a developing country. And what their argument is, they can't afford to send all their, you know, especially if...
Best talent.
Yeah. And if you have been educated in the university and so already you have used up a place and then you are not contributing to the country. So there were a lot of issues like that. So my immediate boss was a very nice man. So he said, how can I recommend you going away? Because you are in the middle of so many projects and, you know, it's like me saying, you know, I can manage without, you know, your input. So then he said, then he, again he knew that we were just married and we want to go for a short term. So then he said, okay, I'll recommend your application. So that it took a long while, but ultimately I got that approval. So on that basis we left, you know.
I just wanted to make one important point was that university education was free in Sri Lanka. So that's why the government felt that if you qualified, even as a doctor or an engineer or any one of those professions, you were bonded to the country. You had to pay back, and pay back.
But by the time you were leaving Sri Lanka, Dad, you would have been how old? 36, 37?
Yes.
So you'd already worked potentially for a good period of time.
No, I was out of that... that sort of constraint. Normally you work for about 3 to 5 years or something and you're out of it. But the fact was you're involved in very important work and then somebody has to recommend that they can manage without you, you know, so that was the issue.
And had you left Sri Lanka prior to going to Nigeria? Was that...
He had been to Japan twice on training.
Yeah.
But this was the first time you were leaving your family for an extended period, whereas you'd already done that because of going to
India
for university. So you go to Nigeria. How was that?
It was challenging, to say the least. There were lots of power cuts, water shortages.
It's a very rough country.
It's a very rough country. Yeah,
especially if you're an expatriate, there are people who want to, you know, hold you up and they'll steal your car.
Did that ever happen to you?
Not to us.
Some of our friends, it did happen. Be very careful, you know, you can't, it's not as you can move around quite freely.
At night, especially.
Okay.
And
I have seen people being lynched with tires put over them and set on fire.
Goodness. In Nigeria,
That is if they
catch you
find
stealing
that,
a car.
Say a Nigerian has done something and they catch you, he has stolen something, then that is their form of justice. You know?
So that's the police doing to them?
No, not really, even the
mobs.
You know, people.
Oh,
the mobs.
Goodness.
So it's very difficult to understand why all that. Again, Nigeria is basically a poor country. The only thing was the oil boom. They had that big income coming in, but corruption is very high. And so the general person is not in any way, you know, that wealth doesn't necessarily mean that people are, you know, getting better or whatever, but...
Did you know all this before going to Nigeria?
No.
Did you have an appreciation?
We had a vague idea. My aunt used to tell us. But there's one interesting anecdote I have to tell you. One of the ministers, he played out the government. You know, I can't remember. It must have been millions. and he went to England, and he had no intentions of coming back. But the Nigerians in Lagos, in Nigeria and in England, conspired to drug him and bring him back to face justice. So they drugged him and put him in a packing crate in Heathrow.
What?
Yeah, to fly him back to Lagos. But unfortunately, the sniffer dogs smelt him out. So the poor man escaped with his life. Otherwise, he would have been lynched.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
True story.
Nigeria had a lot of connections with UK. They used to go, you know, a lot of people go to UK for education, studies and everything. So there was a bit of a thing going on between UK and Nigeria, you know.
Yeah. So how was it while you were in Nigeria, you're working, you're now conscious of the fact that there's lots of potential dangers and, you know, keeping safe, but how was it for you guys to communicate with your families back in Sri Lanka?
Okay. I mean, we had to go to a call center to make a call if we wanted to call home. And I remember when I first got pregnant and I wanted to call my parents and tell them, and you had to go to this call center, book a call, then wait for, I don't know how long, 15, 20 minutes before they connect the call. And the calls are not very clear. And I'm shouting, "Mom, I'm pregnant." And like they couldn't hear. And what? "I'm pregnant." Everyone could hear.
So all of Nigeria knew.
Lagos.
Lagos knew.
Yeah, that's because it was a time before, you know, mobile phones, everything, you know, now it is so
emails
convenient.
Emails or
you
anything.
Know, you
can
personal phones.
Yeah, personal phones or emails. Even
everything. You know, it was just a landline like that, if at all there was a phone there. And and then especially overseas calls, you had to go to the call center.
Oh, so you had a landline to make local calls, but to do an overseas call, you had to go to that call center.
But landline, we didn't have one personally. It was just...
Yeah, but it does work. I mean, that's what the Nigerian said, and the same thing in Sri Lanka. If you wanted to do it like an overseas call, it has to go over the satellite sort of connection. So that's why you had to go to a call center, book that call, and, you know, there was no internet, nothing. So that's how you had to do it, you know. But look, I mean, we did go there, but one thing I would say is we had very good friends, Sri Lankan friends, also living in Lagos at the time. And so we used to sort of move in a little community in, like that. And also we made good friends. There were a lot of expatriates who came there for work and various things.
From all over the world.
From all over the world. Oh. Canada, you know, you name it.
England, U.S.
Holland, you know, there were a whole lot of community like that. So we made friends with them, and so that's what kept us going.
So you're living in Nigeria, and 1981, I believe, is when you went there.
Yes.
And then the war breaks out in Sri Lanka in 1983, and you'd only intended to live 3 years in Nigeria. What happens next?
So I had not planned to have Darshini in Nigeria. So suddenly the war broke out in July. We had to make a decision, and there was no communication. We couldn't reach anybody. But I thought I'm going to take a risk and go back. I think I was able to get one or two calls to my mother. At the initial stages, we didn't even know whether they were safe. During this time, my father had been diagnosed with cancer, so I knew he and my mother had been separated. He was in Colombo getting treatment, whereas my mother was by herself in Kandy. So I decided that I would go because I had not planned to have this first baby in Nigeria. So I did end up going end of August, I remember. I went back to Sri Lanka and things were, you know, had settled down by then. Most things had settled down. There were pockets of unrest here. And you always were tense, you know, you're not knowing when things are. There were police checks everywhere you went. And so anyway, that was how it was. And I had Darshini in a nursing, like they call them nursing homes, but they're little maternity homes. And
yes, I think the big issue was, so the civil war, what happened in 1983, and it was so unpredictable, you know, we couldn't sort of foreseen this happening. And so obviously, it was not a good time for us to get back, because that was the time my contract was ending as well, 83. So I had to, I was so uncomfortable thinking of going back home, because things are not safe, and even in workplaces they were very against minorities, you know, in my case Tamil. And so we heard sort of stories of a lot of harassment and things like that. So,
and because Daddy's work was in the telecoms, which was considered a sensitive area for the government, he would have automatically lost his job
coming back.
Yeah.
But I think, just to go back to you coming to Sri Lanka pregnant.
Very pregnant.
At how many weeks?
32 weeks.
32 weeks pregnant. So Dad's in Nigeria, Lagos. Yeah. You're coming to Sri Lanka by yourself,
yeah.
Not knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
But you had me in Kandy, right?
Yeah.
With your mum.
With your mum, who didn't drive. We didn't have a car.
Oh, my God.
And but I had a very good neighbor, an American family. They were missionaries in Sri Lanka, and they were very good friends of ours. And I remember, because of the war, there was a curfew. And then I started, my waters broke in the middle of the night, but I couldn't get to hospital.
So you literally weren't allowed to break curfew even if you were in labor?
No.
I suppose you could do it, but then it's always a bit of a, you're not sure how things will work out, you know.
So my friend Carol came at 4 o'clock in the morning, that was when curfew was lifted, and she drove me to hospital.
So what time was I born then?
So I, you remember this story, I get a lot of mileage out of this.
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. Oh, she was like in labour for 17 hours apparently. I don't know whether to believe it.
It is true, it is. But then he ended up having a caesarean, but I was in labour for a whole day and a half. No, so I went to hospital, maybe at 8 o'clock at night, so maybe not as much.
See? It's getting revised down as we speak.
I got a lot of mileage out of that.
No, the other thing is, there was no way we could have had that baby in Nigeria, because hospitals were terrible, you know. There were some what they call mission hospitals, but they were quite far away. And also traveling was not easy. So you can't, in an emergency, try and get to hospital. So that's why we thought. And also, being the first child, you just don't know what kind of complications you might get into. So we thought it's best to go back to Sri Lanka and have baby there. You know?
And you didn't even know what you had.
No, because the communication was so difficult, you know.
So you were screaming, "It's a girl!"
No, I was in hospital for a few days, so I don't know how you knew.
And so, just for context, I was born and I didn't get to meet my dad until I was like
2 months.
2 months
two
old.
Months, yeah.
And mum flew back with me.
I still remember when Priyanka came with the baby, you know, and I was at the airport and we just sat there and I was just holding you.
Were you like, oh my God?
I had stuck a ribbon in your hair with sellotape.
Yeah, because my mum shaved my head. Because there's this weird wives' tale that if you shave a newborn's baby head, that your hair grows back thicker.
Okay.
So to
that's
make
true now, no, see?
Yeah, no, it
but
is true.
But the Mimi I didn't shave and
her hair is just as thick. I think it's just probably genetic. So probably to make sure Dad knew I was a girl, I had a pink ribbon sellotape to my head.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
So that's 1983 in September, October, November.
October, November, yeah.
And then you're staying in Nigeria now. So you got your job renewed in Nigeria?
No, so this is what happened. So I had to make a decision, because my initial contract was coming to an end, and then, so that means we leave Nigeria, and there was nowhere to go, because Sri Lanka was not
closed,
an option.
Right.
Began to think about what we are to do and everything. And then fortunately, there was a Chinese businessman whom we
knew
through church and the expatriate community, you know. So he was running a factory and, you know, doing some work there. And so he told me he can give me a job. So that's what I did. Although it was out of my normal field, he was having a... He used to make steel office furniture.
Oh.
You know, like filing cabinets and everything. So just to run the factory and just make sure, you know, things ran okay. So that's what I did. So I moved into that job and for another 3 years.
Four years.
Yeah. Nearly 4 years.
Yeah, so that's 7 years in total.
7 years. So
in Nigeria. Yeah. And then
we had friends, because after the war, all the Sri Lankans were scattering to any country that would take them. So we had friends in Lagos who were coming to Australia as, on family reunion. And so they were urging us to apply as well, and we didn't know anyone to come to Australia to put down as a, you know, family migration. But because they kept urging us, in fact they brought the forms for us from the, you know, from the city and gave it to us and sort of said, literally just sign here. We filled it in, and the next thing we knew, we got passed to come to Australia.
When you come to Australia as a migrant, do you get to choose what city you want to come to? Like, was Melbourne your first port of call? Is this where you came?
No, actually, we chose Brisbane first. I don't know why we chose Brisbane first, but then friends said, you won't get a job in Brisbane. It's better to come to Melbourne. So we came to Melbourne.
And also a lot of our Sri Lankan friends were here in Melbourne. Mm. So,
okay.
So that made sense.
I just to sort of add to this Sri Lankans scattering everywhere, I had cousins who were living in the northern part of Sri Lanka, which is basically a Tamil area. And they were young boys. They were like in their mid-teens or late teens. And soon as the war broke out, the war was against the Tamil Tigers and the government. So the Tamil Tigers were recruiting any young men to come and join them and fight for them. And so my cousins, my aunt was a widow at the time, my cousins were just literally almost put on any carrier that would take them, a ship or anything that would take them. One went to Norway, one went to France. They didn't even know the language or anything, but
They just had to get out.
They just had to get out.
And so going back to the fact then you get accepted into Australia, but that was under a skilled migrant visa, that's right?
Yeah, so just to explain, so we put in our papers and then we had to go for an interview with the First Secretary. So we went for that interview and then so all kinds of questions were asked, you know, how many kids have you got? And he was a very nice man. So he was going on chatting, and for a long time I couldn't make sense of this. I was wondering whether, does this mean I'm passed or, you know, what is happening? So at one point I had to sort of stop him and ask him, does this mean we are passed to go? Then he said, yeah, you don't worry about all that. All that is okay.
No, he said, as long as your medicals are over. And then Daddy was asking about jobs. That's when he said, oh, don't worry about the job. Send your wife out to work. You go play golf.
Yeah, because I was concerned, okay, how do you look for a job? And, you know, I'm just walking in there with maybe my university qualifications. I don't know what they'll make of it and things like that. So, but he was very jovial about it.
And to put it in context, I guess when you were arriving in Australia, you were 43 by then?
Yes, I think something, yeah.
So I guess jobs are something that you're thinking, will you get a job at 43?
Yeah, it is difficult.
And also it's a new culture, it's a new environment.
And
you know, how would they
how
accept
how much
it?
Of my education will people
recognize.
Relate to or recognize or anything like that. So it was a tough, I would say, a little bit unknown sort of thing, you know, which is. But then the first job I applied for was for a similar, like a telecommunication kind of job with the State Electricity Commission, you know. And there again, it's very interesting how things worked out. So I go for this interview and so they look at everything. Now, to put it in context, at that time, there weren't that many brown-skinned Sri Lankans. I'm saying that because in the early 70s, that time we had a lot of
the burghers
who were European, you know,
white-skinned Sri Lankans.
Sri Lankans. So
the Dutch Portuguese descendants.
Yeah. So some of the workplaces they were aware of these people, you know, who were fair-skinned. But you know, in your brown skin, they don't know what to make of you? You know, are you capable of doing something? And so it is a very genuine issue. The boss who interviewed me. However much I told him, you know, I worked in this kind of thing, he still can't judge you whether you're good at it or not, because he's just hearing a story, you know, you have worked there. Just then he was going through my educational details, and then he saw, you know, my university thing, and it was recognized by UK.
And now,
he was a
Englishman.
So then he said, okay, your qualifications look okay. And, you know, because he was comfortable with that, you know. And then he took me on and for the job. But this is where I say that at that time, I felt that Australia gave me a fair go.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise what they were saying every time when some of my friends and all go for job interviews, they want Australian experience, right? So how are you going to show Australian experience if you don't break into your first job? So but you can understand why they think that, because they can't assess how good you are in your work. So, but in my case, at least he was able to give me a chance, so to speak. And so that's how I started. So, no, after that, there were more people coming in, and then, you know, word gets around, you know, that...
the brown people are okay.
People used to ask us, where did you learn to speak English?
Yeah, it was...
People used to constantly ask...
Who was asking that? The Australians were asking that?
Yeah, how did you learn to speak English? In fact, we had a joke going around amongst the migrant community that one of them said, oh, they give us lessons on the plane.
And they believe you.
I mean, they knew you're being facetious there.
I was just going to make a comment to saying it seems that when you came to Australia, that's when we was at the very beginning of our real multiculturalism.
Yes.
I would say so.
Yeah, so
definitely.
Yeah, so that exposure, because they'd had that white policy for such a long time.
Yes.
So it was the real beginning of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so when you came here, I know you came on the 4th of July. And the middle of winter.
Yeah.
What were your impressions?
Oh, I just loved it, Fiona. From day one, I just loved Australia, coming into Melbourne. It was just, for me, it was magical. The cold, the, you know, the bare trees and the... I just loved every aspect.
Everything was different, you know, the trees, vegetation, everything, the seasons, everything was a new experience.
And we sort of saw it as a place that God had led us into.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very important for us too. And I felt like even the fact that we had come to Australia without really looking to come to Australia, all the way things worked out. Like, for example, in Lagos, we had to sell our car. And the government had this peculiar rule that you couldn't send out any money for a period of time or something. There had to be a time. I can't remember how it... Anyway, we sold this car, and it was the exact amount of our one-way flights to Melbourne.
Wow.
So that was, you know...
And the car was sold to an expatriate
missionary.
So, so there were a lot of little things like that.
It was a real God.
And your apartment was just...
Real. These friends who had urged us to move to Melbourne, they had got a job in Moi, so they left their apartment for us. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to get an apartment without a rental history. So, and we only stayed in that apartment 3 or 4 months before we bought this house. So it was like God was always 2 steps ahead of us.
But talk about the cold.
The cold was something else. I did not know what cold was coming from Sri Lanka and Nigeria. So a lady, an Australian friend I had met in Sri Lanka just before I came to Australia, had lent me an overcoat. So I was fine. But these two little girls, 3 and 2, had only little cardigans. They had tracksuits on that I had bought in Sri Lanka. For these hideous pink tracksuits and just little cardigans. And I remember a few days after we had stayed in this apartment in Armadale, we went walking past an op shop. And the old ladies who were running the op shop came running out and, you know, called us in and then gave the girls beanies and gloves. And,
and to be fair, I do actually remember that winter.
Do you?
I do. I remember, I have this vivid memory of stepping off a tram near Armidale and just being like, wow, it's cold. And I think I was clutching either a green or an orange mirror. Do you remember that? You'd bought us like these little mirrors and we used to carry them around. And I just remember thinking, it is so cold. And I was really worried I was going to drop my mirror because my hand was cold.
Yeah, I remember those tiny little mirrors.
Tiny little mirrors. But the cold was something else, I tell you. But how did you make friends in Australia?
I think through the church. The church was a huge place for us to make friends and felt accepted and supported was the word. Because I remember we had no heating in the apartment, and someone from church brought us a heater, you know, things like that. It went a long way.
And you went to a church that was an, I guess what I'm saying is an Australian church, but it wasn't a church that was for Sri Lankans. It was a normal church in the community.
Yeah, but I must
there
say
there were
this,
a few Sri Lankan families there.
When we were in Nigeria, we got a contact of somebody here in one of the churches, and that in Marambina
Baptist Church. They were both missionaries. And so
they gave us this name and said, you know, just make contact. And so that was our first contact, and that's where we went, you know, Marambina.
And then that was July we came, and in January we moved, the next year, 88, we moved to this house.
Yeah.
And what was the first piece of furniture you bought, Mum?
The piano.
We didn't have anything else?
No, we had the dining table, the furniture
we brought from Sri Lanka.
But the first new piece of furniture that was bought...
was the piano.
Was the piano. My mum's a very good piano player.
The other thing is we met the Saddingtons and everybody, and so that was the other friendship group, you know.
The Saddingtons live on the next street, and they're really, you know, wonderful friends to us.
They were wonderful, yeah.
So if you listen back to, I can't remember which episode it was, but there was an episode earlier on where we interview Emma Saddington and she talks about it, but their family has been absolutely instrumental, and John, Emma's dad, helped my dad build the extension to this house.
Mm. I remember taking Dashni to kindergarten on the first day, and Jackie and Emma were there, and Jackie said, oh, who do we have here, or something like, you know, that. And then Jackie used to pass on older girls' clothes to my younger children. They're wonderful people, absolutely wonderful people.
Mm. I remember the interview that we did of Emma, and the stories were just brought me to tears when she's talking about her dad and your dad together.
Yeah.
It was really beautiful, really beautiful. I felt like Emma felt like she visited your parents more than you did, Dash.
And she'd always walk in through the back door, I remember.
She'd come for breakfast here and then we'd go to school together. But I think, like, even to this day, the Saddingtons will drop in and you guys will drop in at the Saddingtons. Like, there's still this, like,
during
back
COVID,
door.
During COVID, when we were supposed to be in isolation, Jackie and I would meet up.
And make masks. And feel like that covered their sin of breaking.
Oh, no, we'd do. We'd not all only making masks. We would be having cups of tea, and then Emma would call.
They'd have to pretend.
And she said, are you breaking COVID? No. We are just caring for each other.
So now you've been in, I know there's been a lot that has happened. You've had three girls in total who've all married white boys.
Yeah.
You have lots of grandkids. And fur babies and magpies and have, you know, how do you view your identity now?
I see myself as an Australian.
Yeah.
In fact, it's funny, I belong to a patchwork group, a lovely, lovely group of ladies, and they don't even see me that I'm different from them. They don't, someone made that comment about and said, really? Are you a coloured person? Or, you know, something to that effect. They couldn't even see that I was any different to them.
Yeah. And that was a good thing for you.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. What about you, Dad?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of changes in the cultures. I mean, okay, in Sri Lanka we had, you know, a certain cultural norm and everything. And then, you know, you go to Nigeria for a short time, then you come here. And then you pick up new values, new So it has been changed, but changed for the good, you know. And but having said that, we can't forget our mother country, you know. Whatever it is, your young days, you know, it's all still part of you. And also your siblings and everybody whom you've grown up with. So, and even my classmates and university mates, they are still good friends of mine, you know. So you live with all that rich history, you know. It's not as if you give up one and take up another, you know. It's just an embellishment, you know. So I find it quite exciting.
What I love about Australia, Melbourne especially, is the multicultural aspect of it. Some of my closest friends are from, you know, the other countries, from UK, from Singapore, Venezuela, Peru. You know, I would have never met these people if I had lived in Sri Lanka.
But I think it's an interesting thing, like, of a migration story, to be able to hold the identity of your homeland and to know I came from that, that's my history, and Sri Lanka has a rich history.
Yeah, it does.
And I know every time we've gone back and, you know, you've shown us around to some of those ruins and you think, wow, like they're 400 BC or something like that. Like, it's pretty incredible as a country. But then to also hold the history of being migrants that have been in Australia for a very long time and having the connections into community in a way that maybe new migrants coming in may not see as possible yet. So I'm just wondering, to finish, what advice or thoughts would you give any new migrants who are in Melbourne or Australia?
I think one thing is, be patient, give yourself time to integrate, and also most importantly, integrate into society. Don't, you know, live in a little enclave of Sri Lankan friends only.
Mm.
You know, mix around and, you know, get involved in society, do your bit. I believe in, you know, giving back to society. Australia has given us so much that we are so very, very grateful to Australia for taking us in. So much so that on the 4th of July, many times we have actually had a commemoration Thanksgiving time.
Yeah.
We are very grateful for the way we came here and for what we enjoy here now. When I look at you guys, you know, my three daughters have married well, doing well, and I've got beautiful grandchildren. And I'm very, very grateful.
It's been a great story.
Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.